We're starting a new month, a new factor this month. It's the third factor in the factors of awakening. So it's energy. And I thought I would read that Hafiz poem around everything being sacred, because the sacredness of life has a lot to do with energy. And it may not seem like it at first kind of thought or first glance, but the more sacred we hold life, the more energy we have to live it. Meaning that the less we're trying to control life and fix life and make life a certain way, and that we just hold life as sacred, whatever arises, it's this too on the path, then there's less resistance to life and we have more energy, this virya. So we're going to talk a little bit about virya. Virya, as energy itself, shows up in many different aspects of the practice. So a lot of these factors, you'll notice, of these seven factors, I'm just thinking, taking a moment to check here, but I'm pretty sure every single one shows up in many different avenues, many different of the list of practices. So sometimes we can think of this practice as a series of lists, and many of these factors show up on many different lists. And I think the best way to hold this idea that all these factors are showing up on different lists is because it's not really as linear as we kind of make it out to be. It's not really that linear. Energy is energy is energy. Virya is virya is virya. Whatever place along our practice that virya can support us, that is where virya shows up at. But when you look at someone who has an awakened mind, what you would see is these seven factors that we're going through. And what you would not see is they have abandoned the five hindrances we started out with. So there's a way in which an awakened mind rests within these seven factors and at the same time has abandoned the habitual reactiveness of the five hindrances. So, energy, it's an inherent quality. It's one of the faculties, the five faculties. So it's inherent in the mind. It is not connected to vitality. I mean, there might be some degree of vitality that you could feel, but that's not the energy I think that the practice is pointing to. I don't think it's vitality. You know, that sense of aliveness we can have, and you could say, oh, I have all this vitality to go out and do something. And at the same time, you could have no vitality. Kitasaro, when he was practicing with Ajahn Chah and he was in Asia, he got, I always thought it was malaria, but someone told me it was Typhoid Mary. Is that Typhoid Mary? Typhoid fever, that's what it is. He got very, very sick. So sick he could not even, it was too much to even open his eyes. He just could not even lift his eyelids up. It was too stressful, too much energy. And he was, you know, pretty close to death for a long time. But what he said he did every single day was repeat the Great Compassion Mantra 5 times a day. So the Great Compassion Mantra is a whole bunch of tones. Tones, 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 tones. if you were to hear it, it wouldn't necessarily make any sense. It just sounds like someone's just bombing, that's all you're really doing. And that he would barely have the energy to even get the full tone out. But he had virya in his practice. That's what that is. That's virya. That's not vitality, that's virya. So I'd like to talk about virya two ways. One way is tonight, we're going to talk about it as it points to commitment to practice. And then tomorrow, next week, we're going to talk about it as right effort, which is where it's on the path. That right effort is shows up on the path, and that's the same kind of energetic flow. And then I'm going to my teacher training in August again, and so someone will be covering for me the third week, and then the fourth week we'll have a discussion night on these topics. I think in some respects, trying to practice with virya is the hardest. I shouldn't say it is the hardest. It's one of these hard things with practice. And I think it's hard because we think energy, just the use of that word, the way we think about it as, oh, I got to be upbeat. I got to be motivated and ready to go. And it's as if we think I got to practice making myself have energy. And if I made myself have more energy, then I could practice. But that thinking is in some respects why I think it's so hard to cultivate energy and why we have so much difficulty around energy itself, the cultivation of energy in practice. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about where how do we cultivate and develop this sense of, I think commitment is probably a better way to say it, a commitment or an intention to practice. Some of the reason why it could be a little difficult to practice with energy, this idea of how do I cultivate energy? So if we're going to cultivate each one of these factors, how do I cultivate the factor of energy? Comes from some of the English ways, and not just English, but that the words that we use to talk about this practice. So we talk about it as a path. We talk about it as a spiritual journey. And anybody that knows anything about going on a hike or going on anything that requires a journey in, there is a sense that you got to have some kind of energy to do that. You can't just go on your journey. You got to build up the capacity to want to go on that journey and then put the effort in to go. And there is a bit of there is an effort. So there's no question that we don't need an effort. And we do need some energy. That's the whole point of energy being the third factor. So these are the upside, the uplifting side of the factors. And then towards the end of the year, we're going to move down to the calming side. So we do need some uplift, some wind beneath our sails, kind of, or wings, wind beneath our wings. We need some of that, right? But it's how to cultivate that wind against the mental thought that I have to do something to make myself more energized. So I thought, to put us in perspective, I want to read you some of the suttas, the way the Buddha talked about this energy, so that we can get a sense for what we're talking about here. So he said, in one sutta, he says, those who are ever vigilant, whose who disciplines themselves day and night and are ever intent upon Nibbana, their defilements fade away. Ever intent, day and night, ever vigilant. Here's another one. He says, rouse yourself, sit up. What good is there in sleeping? For those affected by the disease of suffering, struck by the arrow of craving, what sleep is there? Rouse yourself, sit up. Resolutely train yourself to attain peace. Do not let the king of death, seeing you are careless, lead you astray and dominate you. That's pretty rousing. Rousing. He says, never let the mind leave the body. Right? So you're always keeping the mind with the body. In the Satipatthana, he says, he or she or the practitioner lives, this is how we live, contemplating mental objects. I'm just doing the fourth foundation. Lives contemplating mental objects in mental objects, ardent, clearly comprehending them, and mindful of them, having overcome in this world covetousness and grief. Gets deeper. He says, stay mindful and alert. This is our instruction to you all. And how is a practitioner mindful? There is the case where a practitioner remains focused on the body in and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful, subduing greed and distress with reference to the world. They remain focused on feelings, mind qualities in and of themselves, ardent, alert, and mindful, subduing greed and distress with reference to the world. And how is a practitioner alert? There is the case where feelings are known as they arise, known as they persist, known as they subside. Thoughts are known as they arise, known as they persist, known as they subside. Perceptions are known as they arise, known as they persist, and known as they subside. So stay mindful and alert. This is our instruction to you. Yeah, this got to take some serious energy. Words like heedful, ardent, resolute. This is the energy that we're working with. I got two more. Just as when a person whose turban or head was on fire would put forth extra desire, effort, diligence, endeavor, undivided mindfulness and alertness to put out the fire on his or her turban or head. In the same way, a practitioner should put forth extra desire, effort, diligence, endeavor, undivided mindfulness and alertness for the abandonment of those very same evil or unskilled qualities. That really puts a little strike in there, putting a nail. Got one more nail for the coffin here. So the Buddha says, though only my skin, sinews, and bones remain, and my blood and flesh dry up and wither away, yet never will I give up my quest and swerve from the path of enlightenment. So this is what we're working with on this energy. So you're sitting here in this heat, many of you having worked all day. Can you see how impossible it is for you to generate that energy? And that's what the mind convinces us, that's what we have to do. We have to generate this kind of energy in order for us to practice. But these energetic places that all of these places are pointing to is not physical will. It's not willed energy. It's intention. It's the spark behind energy. It's this holding of life in the sacred way so that practice and all that is practice becomes a part of how we practice. There's a way in which the practice can begin to build upon itself. That's the part I want to talk about tonight. This way in which practice builds upon itself and generates its own energy towards awakening. A way you can think about this is, if you go on a retreat, you would think, if someone were to tell you, okay, a retreat, you have to get up at 5 a.m. for a 6 a.m. sit, first sit, 6 a.m. The last sit is at 9 o'clock at night. And you're gonna sit and walk and practice all day long. If you were anything like me, I used to think that has got to be the most boringest day ever. There's no way I could sit up and do that without falling asleep. And there is, when you very first get to a retreat, this massive sleepiness. But the sleepiness is not coming from the meditation, it's coming from the letting go of all the craziness we lived in before we got on that retreat. And once we finally settled down into the retreat practice, sleepiness shifts, and now you have to deal with restlessness, like all this extra energy that you don't seem to be getting rid of. You have to sit more. Like the more you sit, the more you need to sit. The more you sit, the more you need to walk. You need to sit, you need to walk in order to keep the energy that's coming at you as the retreat progresses. I've seen people go on retreat. They kind of like play a little bit in the beginning because they're so sleepy. Play a little bit. Then they start getting serious, a little bit more serious. But if you let your mind spin around in all these worldly life things and less about turning towards practice, it won't be long before you find yourself fighting with the hindrances for the whole retreat. And people will come to me and say, I just had this retreat and I'm stuck in the hindrances. I just could not get out. It is this thing that's happening that I want to talk about. This thing that's happening, you can see it in a retreat center, a retreat setting, better than you can see it in urban life. But the same thing is happening to us in our urban practice. For your mind, if you come to Sims week after week after week after week, even if your only sitting was at Sims on Monday night, and then you don't sit anymore, and then Monday night, and then you don't sit anymore, and then Monday night, and you just keep doing this cycle, the mind is beginning to get that cycle into a habitual understanding. And it is beginning to use that cycle to generate energy. It's generating the same energy it generates at a retreat. When we're at a retreat, we take that energy and we funnel it into the practice. That's what we do. That's why it's sitting and walking and sitting and walking. And we just keep funneling that energy into the practice, into the practice, into the practice. And the practice itself leads towards deep samadhi. There are, it doesn't matter how long you're at that retreat. It doesn't matter who you are, what kind of mind you have, how long you've been practicing. Inevitably, that retreat is going to smooth into samadhi by the end of it. It's this constant bringing it back onto the path, bringing it back onto the cushion, bringing it back into your chair, coming in, sitting. So if you think about this idea that everything that happens to you is sacred, then even in this urban life we live, where we're not sitting and walking and sitting and walking all day, that everything becomes practice, then you're bringing everything back onto the path. And that bringing everything back onto the path is what's going to generate this ardent paying attention, being mindful. That's what's going to generate this sense of urgency, like your head is on fire, this diligence, endeavoring mindfulness to pay attention to what you're doing. It's only because you hold everything as practice, not because you're doing something to make yourself more energized. Do you see what I'm saying? As long as we hold our practice as if it's practice, hold our life as practice, your mind has no way of knowing whether you're practicing or not. We know this because when we're sitting on the cushion, some thought comes up in our heads. We're there. Our body is moving and all these things are going on. We're kind of lost in the world of whatever that thought is. And we don't even remember that we're sitting on a cushion doing nothing. We're just sitting here doing nothing. We've lost our bodies. So to the mind, whatever you're doing, it's always thinking. It's always in the exact same position that it is in when you are sitting still practicing. It does not change. It has not, it's nothing new. It's not, oh, if I sit on the cushion or if I sit in my chair, oh, now the mind knows we're meditating. But if I'm at the grocery store, the mind doesn't know. The mind doesn't know you're sitting either. He doesn't know you're meditating. So it's that grocery meditation. You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't know either way. It's how you as a practitioner hold going to the grocery store. If you hold it as this careless, doing nothing, wandering about, let the mind do whatever it wants, then the mind will do whatever it wants. But then when you try to get to the cushion, it's going to do it there too. It's this developing of a consistency that all life is practice. Everything you do is practice. It's not this judgment that my practice is the peaceful, blissful moments of stillness. Your practice is just your capacity to stay conscious what's going on. Keep the mind next to the body. Don't let the mind leave it. So if your body is at the grocery store, that's where your mind should be. If your body is at work, that's where your mind should be. Wherever your body is, that's where the mind should be. That's what you're trying to do. That's how you begin to develop this energetic capacity. But there is a but. Because the same, that energy that gets developed in the mind from practice, it's not you doing that energy, it's the mind that does this energy, just because you keep bringing the mind back to the body. So wherever the body's at, that's where the mind's at. Keep bringing it back, keep bringing it back, keep bringing it back. Something begins to happen. The mind begins to get concentrated. Now at retreats, when we begin to get concentrated, it moves towards samadhi. It moves towards the seven factors of enlightenment. But when we're kind of careless about, it begins to move towards the hindrances, our habitual ways of responding to pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. The mind begins to grab around something it likes or something it doesn't like. First time I began to notice this, I was at a retreat and I was very still. This was into the retreat. In fact, this was the first, I think this was the very first long retreat I ever went to. So I'm in it, deep into this retreat. I'm very still, peaceful, and next thing I know, I am having these averse, rampant, beating the crap out of anybody and everybody, cussing people out in my mind. I'm sitting here so averse and full of all this just rage, and I kept thinking, what is going on? Like, why am I so angry? I should be peaceful and calm. I should be happy. And somewhere in my mind, I got the thought, wait, I might be telling a little bit about me, but okay, I'm gonna tell you anyway. I got this thought, wait, that's not what I'm really feeling and thinking. That's the habit go-to energy. I'm getting all this energy that's coming up in practice. If I don't focus it towards the remaining calming factors that we're going to talk about in a few couple of months, I think it's just like maybe one more month of energy, which is joy. If I don't move that towards the calming, I basically said, this is rapture. This is energetic uplift that is not being used. And so the mind goes to its habitual energies. So if you're a desirous person, it's going towards desire. Wanting, 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 wanting. You just get the wanting craze and all of a sudden you can't seem to shut that faucet off. For me, I have so much aversion all the time that my mind goes to aversion and it starts complaining, grumbling, fussing. Just this constant. So when I stopped believing that I am angry or I am, something's wrong, I'm mad, I'm this, I'm that, and I just begin to see it as this is undirected energy. This is energy trapped in habit and not energy focused towards practice. Then these hindrances begin to change a bit. I begin to turn it. So when I would be sitting there and I start having this sense of something's gone awry, I begin to turn that energy towards the body, staying right here, being peaceful. It's not even being peaceful like not gonna be energized or not gonna be, I'm just going to be like a marshmallow. It's not like that kind of peaceful, but it's, I'm not upset because the mind is angry. I'm not upset, or I don't think there's anything wrong with whatever has arisen here. I can begin to see this clear seeing that this is a habit of mind that has arisen, and that the calming energies are just going to turn this towards awakening in practice. Not, I'm going to fight against this and try to make myself be more peaceful, be more calm, be more meditative. Can you understand what I'm saying? This energetic part here. Next week we're going to talk about this, the effort of how to move through some of these skillful and unskillful things that have arisen. So when certain unskillful, like my aversion, when it's arisen, there's a way in which we move through this skillfully and unskillfully. But that's not what I'm talking about tonight. What I'm talking about is beginning to see that you are not generating that energy. You can't practice week after week. Some of you have daily sits. You can't practice and sit daily without generating energy. And it's what are you doing with the energy that you're generating? Are you recognizing that when you sit, it does bring peacefulness sometimes to us, but it also generates energy, and that energy needs to be directed towards awakening. And what it means, that's what we're going to talk about next week, is how we direct it towards awakening. But the practice itself is what's generating this energy. And you can create more capacity for practice by holding everything you do as sacred and part of the path. Everything that happens, everything that comes to you, everything that you do is all part of the path. It's all part of practice. And so nothing that happens is a moment of careless, we're not on a break. You're kind of hooked now. Rodney used to say that after the beginning class. You know, after the beginning class, and the beginning people would be at the Sims, at the regular weekly sit, he'd say, well, you're hooked now, so you might as well settle in with it. I don't have my quote, but I think it was Trungpa Rinpoche who said, you know, if you're just coming on the path and you're having some difficulty, you might want to get out now before you get too deep, because it's pretty ugly. It's going to get pretty ugly before it gets better. So there's a way in which that's where everybody here is already on the path. So your minds are already cultivating energy. When we don't pay attention to that cultivation that's already happening, the mind can get stuck in this concentrated way on our reactivity in the hindrances. And all we want to do is reframe it towards using this energy towards awakening. I always remind myself something that Philip Moffat said one time at his non-residential. He said that the Buddha, when he awakened, he was a little hesitant about teaching this. He didn't really want to go out and teach. And a lot of the devas were like, no, 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 you have to teach, you have to teach. Some people have just a little dust in their eyes and you can clear it up. So you have to teach. And I always thought that the reason why Buddha did not want to teach is because this would be too hard for people to get, too subtle, too difficult to get. But Philip said that was not why he did not want to teach. He was hesitant because it was too easy And he did not think people would believe him if he told people what is required. And just think about our practice. I've been practicing almost 30 years. 30 years. I'd say the first 20 was unnecessary. I could have just wiped that off and started at year 20. It took me 20 years just to understand that I was making more out of the practice than I had to. It's as if we don't realize. It's this idea that there's a self here. The mind thinks there's a me here doing it. The mind already knows how to do this. And so this is not about you or me doing something to make our practice a certain way. This is about recognizing the mind already has this capacity to awaken. And how am I disrupting that natural flow? Philip Moffitt, he's my mentor, so I'm hearing him in my mind all the time. He always says that the mind is moving towards awakening. It's sort of like anybody that's ever worked in an office, you will understand what I'm going to say. You set your mind that I'm going to go in and I'm going to get that paper done. Get that whatever thing I got to get done. I'm going to get that done. Maybe this is everybody's job. I just happen to work in an office. But I'm going to go into work and I'm going to get this project done. And then the telephone rings and people coming in the door. And this breaks down, and then you gotta go have tea, and if you were like me, I used to smoke, so every 10 minutes I gotta go have a cigarette. There's all this interruption that starts happening. And we think that if I could just stop that interruption, then I could get done what I need to get done. So a good way to think about us in practice. We are the interruption. We're the ones that keep interrupting the mind from moving towards awakening because of our identification with all of the things that the mind sees along the path. Everything the mind experiences along the path, we start identifying with it. Just like the phone rings, we let go of our paper, our project, and we turn towards the phone. Or somebody knocks on the door, we let go of our project and we turn towards them. That's what we're doing. We keep letting go of the path and turning towards some interference, some disruption. Instead, we want to stay on the path even if something comes up. We stay on the path. And if that means we have to move them in over here as part of the path, they're all part of the path. So I'm typing and I'm listening to you at the same time. I may not hear everything you got to say, but I'm typing. That's what all these things are. It says it in this big kind of like heavy weighted way, but really it's all stay on the path and bring the object outside to the path. Stay on the path. That's what we're doing. So let me end with a little poem here in my favorite poem book. This is called The Journey by Linda Hogan. The mouth of the river may be beautiful. It doesn't remember the womb of its beginning. It doesn't look back to where it's been or wonder who ahead of it is going to polish the rough stones. It is following the way in its fullness, now like satin, now cresting, waters meeting, kindred to travel gathered together, all knowing its flow. Flowing one way, shining or in shadows. And me, the animal, I ride, wants to drive forward. Its longing not always my own, overrunning its banks and bounds, edgeless, spilling along the way. Because as I forget, the river knows everything is before it. So let's just sit a moment and let these words kind of settle. So no matter what you're doing, no matter what's going on, just make it a habit to ask yourself, where is the mind? Where is the body? And bring the mind back to the body. Thank you very much for your practice. Appreciate it. We'll see if there's any questions. Oh, yes.
So if the point is to bring the body back to the body, how does that
Oh, I see what you're saying. So the question is, if we bring in the mind back to the body, how do we take into account creativity and imagination, things like that, that aren't necessarily body-centered? And I think the creativity and the imagination, it's not that the mind has to always be focused on the body, but that you have to know the mind is creative. No, it's like you're aware that you're in, not me being creative, but I'm aware of the moment that creativity is happening. That's what bringing the mind back to the body means. Not necessarily focused on body, but you're aware that there's a pleasant feeling or an unpleasant feeling. You're aware that the mind is being creative and that the mind is in its imaginative capacities. That's what bringing it back to the body is that awareness of whatever's happening. Yes.
It's creating that anxiousness. But there are other times when I'm sitting and I'm letting everything settle, a deep emotion arises. And that emotion feels true. And then I feel like I'm doing a different thing. I'm not trying to say, okay, let me get back to the energy, get away from this thing. about different things that might manifest in a sort of superficial similarity?
So the comment is that sometimes on retreat you can be sitting and some energy will come up and the mind will take that energy and call it anger. Sort of like that's what I was talking about. And other times, just the purging nature of practice, anger will come up, old anger will come up, and that it feels like there is a different doing with that thing. And there is and there isn't. Some of what you're talking about is what we're going to talk about next week. It's the actual right effort on how to be with whatever is arising in the moment. But even emotions, there are sensations with emotions, there are narratives with emotions, and there are like moods, attitudes in the mind with emotions. If you just keep an emotion clumped together, so anger has come up, and I'm angry, and I know what I'm angry about, and this I'm remembering this story. If you keep it clumped together, you will get identified in that story, and you will just live out the story. And many people talk. Sometimes it sounds like that's what many people do. They live out that story in their sit as if I'm working with the anger that's come up from the fight I had with my sister when we were kids, right? And I'm working that out. Unfortunately, you are not working that out. You are maybe shifting in it to another part of the body, but you are keeping it locked in. Because the emotions, because the mind holds memory, emotions are separate from detail, narrative. But the mind glues it together, and then when we remember it as if it's glued together. So the story of that fight I had and the emotion of that fight I had are glued together. The body is trying to get rid of the story. It's trying to get rid of that memory. That's why it's coming up. It's trying to get rid of things. So instead, what you're trying to do is let go of the story, the narrative, the words, and just let the body feel whatever sensation it's going to feel. But as soon as you let go of the words and you just feel the sensation, there's no more story to it. You can't really say this is anger anymore. It's only anger if you have it connected to this event where I got mad. And that's this event that happened and the emotion of anger is tied to it. But if you begin to work on uncoupling that story to that sensation and that mood in the mind, then what you end up with is a mood in the mind, sensations, and some words, and the three are not glued together. And when they're not glued together, it's very difficult trying to say, I'm angry. You can feel it as energy, but it's very difficult to say, I'm disappointed, I'm sad, I'm this, I'm that. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I get that you don't want to get swept away. Yeah, it might get longer.
I guess I'll say it like this. I'll use something a little bit closer to home, because some of you know my sister died unexpectedly. My baby sister. So every once in a while, I think about her and I think about her being gone and I like burst into tears. Anybody's ever lost anyone, you know that. So you just like burst into tears and you're all upset and I'm glued to this sadness. But then other times, I can feel there's a heaviness or there's a weariness. But I'm not really thinking about her at all. There's just kind of this heaviness. I wouldn't necessarily call it sad, but there's a felt sense of sensations. It doesn't become sad until I think about Janice, and then psh, it's like, oh, I'm sad. That's it. So we'll talk more about this next week. But keeping that narrative tied to the emotions is not so skillful. It's not so skillful because it begins to hold, it takes away our capacity to be with reality, is what really is happening. So she is gone, and in reality, I gotta hold the sadness and the fact that she's gone at the same time. So sometimes, I mean, I can't make myself not put those two together. I don't worry about when it's cooked together and when it's not. All I know is that when the mind does not hook it together, I have capacity to do whatever I need to do and still have that kind of heaviness. But when they're hooked together and there's sadness, I don't have capacity. So that hooking together and unhooking is what the mind does. I just need to be aware that when I'm in that kind of tight, constricted place, the mind has glued some things together. And I need that uncoupling. We can't, it's not something we're going to do by force. I'm not going to make myself uncouple this. But just the knowing that this is habit of mind, this is the mind hooking things together, begins to create enough space for the mind to unhook sometimes, hook sometimes, unhook sometimes, hook sometimes. So that's what you're doing. So that might be what you're pointing to, is the different kind of something has come up and I can't force it apart. But sometimes it comes up and I have more space around it, and sometimes it comes up and I don't have more space around it. It's really just the knowing that that's what's happening. It's not you. It's just the nature of the mind's holding, whatever that is. Good. What happened is that's your nervous system. So the question is, like, there was a time when I when she had an experience where somebody was yelling at her, and she remembered her intention not to cause harm. So there was all this energetic flow in the body and rippling through the body, but not the thoughts of anger and all of that other stuff that comes with it, and trying to get my way, and I'm right, and you need to hear my side. So we can feel the energy of the body, but we're not, but there's something different. So I guess the question is, what is that? What happens with that anger? What happens with that energy? What is that when it ripples through and it goes away? And I think that that rippling you're talking about is your nervous system, which is what a nervous system is designed to do. It's designed to rev us up when there's some danger. But how we actually respond in actuality comes from our intentions, not from the nervous system. So the nervous system may rev up all that energy, but if it doesn't have an identification to glue onto, then it works it up and then it dissipates it. But if we get it attached to some identification of something, then the two become glued together. And then we have to spend time ungluing, uncoupling that together. So that's why we spend so much time in this anger about how could they, even if we don't say anything, how could they talk to me like that? How could they do that? I can't believe that happened. And we spend all this time still living in the past when the past is no longer applicable anymore. But what happens, what you described is a perfect example of being in a present moment. The energy rises from the nervous system doing what the nervous system is designed to do. But because you didn't attach to it with identification, then that energy rises and then the nervous system sees I don't need to do anything and then it just lets it go. The question would be, do you still reiterate the thoughts about what happened? Or is that just as gone as the energy? It's just gone. It doesn't happen. That's it. That's the way life is. So some things we have to do things in the moment right here and now. And we have the capacity to do that. But some things just come up, has nothing to do with us, come up and they go away. But we have to learn how to hold all of that. Learn how to be with it one way or the other. And that's what I think your mind did. And the thing that makes it so strange is, I didn't do it. So how did that happen? If I didn't do it, who did it? And that's what I'm saying. The mind does it. It naturally knows how to just stay right here and not go any, not identify with it. We probably should stop. I thought I was going to leave early, but clearly we didn't.